This time the children are dismissed. If they would like to go to children's church, they are welcome to do so. Look at them go. That's great. All right. Hey, I'm going to be speaking to you from Ephesians 5 today, so I'd encourage you to open your Bibles to Ephesians chapter 5. If you didn't think to bring your own Bible, there's one in the pew, and you would find this text on page 1159. Page 1159. Being a Steeler fan, this is kind of a weird thing to say, but one of my favorite people is John Madden. If you lived in the 70s, you know why that's a weird thing to say, because the criminal element in the NFL was coached by John Madden back then. That would have been the Oakland Raiders at the time. I really liked Madden, and when he retired, I found it was kind of sad, because there was no one to poke fun at, and there was no one to pick on, and there was no one to mock, and there was no one to impersonate. And it was fun to impersonate John Madden. You know, you'd say, "Here's the lane! This is the lane!" And, you know, I'd had a good time doing that sort of thing. In fact, in impressions or impersonations, those are something I like to do, and my family tells me I'm absolutely no good at it. In fact, when I do The Godfather, they just shake their head and say, "No, that isn't it, Dad, that isn't it." And when Esther went to Scotland, she came back and said, "You cannot speak in a Scottish accent, don't ever try that again, you're no good at it." I have a feeling there are some people that impersonate me. I know, for example, that Matt McCracken can spin a pretty good impersonation of some of his former employees, and I don't know, Matt, do you ever impersonate me? I thought so. I kind of thought so, yeah. Maybe he uses lines I've used in sermons. Maybe when he's preaching, he does this, because I do this when I'm preaching a lot. I don't know why I do that, but I do it. Now you'll never be able to do anything except watch me doing this now when I'm preaching. Put that hand behind my back or something. Actually, what people are doing when they impersonate your pastor is they're trying desperately to be as cool as him. That's what's going on there, yeah. It's not always wise to impersonate some people, though. For example, I read an article this past week about a gentleman in Shreveport, Louisiana, who was impersonating police officers by putting a light on his car. He seemed to think that was a good idea. Here was his thinking. The impersonator said, "Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put this light on my car, and I'll put a siren in it, maybe. And then when I'm caught in traffic, I'll just turn that baby on." And you know what it did? It cut his commute time like you would not believe. Because everyone would pull over and then he'd just speed by and you know, that was a good idea for a little while. And then he pulled up behind Cedric Glover, who was going kind of slow, and he threw on the light. And what he didn't realize is that was the mayor. Cedric Glover was the mayor of Shreveport. And the mayor got on his cell phone and said, "Hey, somebody's pulling me over and he's not one of our boys. I want to know who this is." And that was the end of the impersonation of the police officer in Shreveport. You can get arrested for that sort of thing. Interesting, you can get arrested for impersonating a police officer, but you can't get arrested for impersonating a deity. I mean, you could walk right out of here and say, "I'm God," and no one's going to arrest you. They'll think you're crazy, they'll quit listening to you. The only time you can get arrested for impersonating a deity that really is well known in history is in first century Jerusalem, when Jesus wasn't just impersonating a deity, he was telling people, "I am deity," because he was. He was God in the flesh. And that is part of the reason he was arrested. They called that blasphemy, impersonating a deity. He wasn't. I would like to suggest to you that I don't want you to impersonate a deity, but today I would like to suggest to you that we all need to imitate the deity. That is, we need to imitate God. And that idea comes right from this text. It comes from Ephesians chapter 5. So take a look with me, if you would, at Ephesians chapter 5, starting at verse 1. We're going to read verses 1 and 2, and then we're going to skip down to 5. It says, "Be imitators of God, therefore, as dearly loved children, and live a life of love just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God." And now, if you would, please skip down to verse 5. "For this, of this you can be sure." Now pause a minute. Here's why we're skipping to verse 5. He's going to mention several things in verses 1 through 4, and then he has that word, "For of this you can be sure." And so verses 5 through 7 are explaining Paul's rationale of the commandments he's giving you in the earlier verses. And so he says in verse 1, "Be imitators of God." And then in verse 5, he begins to tell you why. "For of this you can be sure. No immoral, impure, or greedy person, such man's an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Let no one deceive you with empty words. For because of such things, God's wrath comes on those who are disobedient. Therefore, do not be partners with them." I want to talk to you a little bit about this concept of imitating God. And I guess when we think of the phrase, be imitators of God, one of the first questions that should come to mind is, what exactly does that mean? I mean, what does it mean to imitate God? And if you look at mankind's history, even though that might seem like a silly question, I would say to you that since the Garden of Eden, people have been confused about what it means to imitate God. The serpent, he tricked Eve. You know, cast the setting here for yourselves, and you imagine Adam and Eve living in a paradise called Eden. There's a serpent, and it turns out he's the devil. He shows up, and he says to Eve words like this. He says, you know, this thing about eating this fruit, God knows that when you eat it, you'll be like him. If you'll just eat the fruit, then you can imitate God. You'll be God. God's trying to keep something good from you. And Eve is deceived by that, but please don't think that the fact that she was deceived lets her off the hook. I can remember when I was younger thinking, it's not really fair if Eve was tricked into this, then how could God hold that against her? She didn't know what she was doing, right? She knew what she was doing. And she was deceived in a sense of this, aha, here I can get something that will put me on par with God. And so Eve finds herself guilty of misunderstanding what it means to be like God, thinking that that means being all-knowing and everything else that she saw in God. For her, it meant having divine knowledge and maybe even being God. You know, even today, cults draw people in with the promise of divinity. For example, if you read some cult literature online, and I do stuff like this more often than I should, you see that cults try to draw people in by the promise of helping them recognize their divine nature. If you come here, you can discover the divine that is within yourself. And for a while, we called that the New Age movement. It's nothing new. It's been around forever. The same old lie. Here's what you have to understand. When the Bible talks about imitating God, what it means at its very core is being like him in a moral sense. Imitating God means being pure or holy or righteous. And God actually commands that. More than one place, he says, be holy as I am holy. And perhaps Peter best verbalizes this in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 14, where he says, as obedient children, don't conform to the evil desires you had when you lived in ignorance. But just as he who called you is holy, just as Jesus is holy, Peter's saying, so be holy in all you do. For it is written, be holy, because I am holy. And so when we talk about imitating God, we're talking about living a morally upright life. We're talking about righteousness. We're talking about holiness. And you can see that imitating God is about more than just following him. You know that I love the King James Bible, but I feel it kind of misses the point here. Because in the King James, verse 1 says, be ye therefore followers of God as dear children. And I understand what the King James is saying there, but today, in our sense, a follower does not necessarily imitate the ones they follow. For example, I follow the Pittsburgh Penguins on Twitter, but you don't see me impersonating them or imitating them. Maybe you follow the Steelers, or maybe Penn State. Maybe you follow Denver, but I don't see you impersonating them. Following doesn't mean, in our language today, impersonating or imitating. The actual word that's used there in the Greek is the word from which we get our word mimic in the English language. And so it means just what the modern translators say. It means to act like God. It means to copy the actions of God. It means to behave like God in different situations. And so logically thinking, imitating God means to consider what Jesus would have done in a given situation. It means asking yourself, what would Jesus do in my situation? You know, that what would Jesus do thing that kind of swept Christendom in the 90s or so, it got a lot of bad press from some alleged or supposed Christian leaders. And I'll never understand that. I never understand why, how someone can look at the prayer of Jabez, or how someone can look at the purpose-driven life, or how someone could look at what would Jesus do, something that is filled with biblical principles like that, and say, that's not right. That's not right. And I got to tell you, here's what I've come to. At 51 years of age, in most cases, it's just raw jealousy that causes leaders to do that and bloggers to blog that way. It's just they're envious. You understand, a large part of what Jesus did in his 3 years of ministry was disciple 12 men so they could later ask themselves, what would Jesus do? What would he do if he were in this situation? He was teaching them to imitate his ways and means. He was hoping, even more deeply than that, he was hoping that they would catch his heart. And Paul did the same kind of thing. The Apostle Paul is speaking to some disciples in Corinth, and he says this. He says, follow my example, mimic me, imitate me as I imitate Christ. And so imitating Jesus means considering, what would he do when confronted with a similar situation, a similar decision? You know, I like to kind of think back to the life of Jesus and kind of notice a few things that I see in his life that I really need to work on imitating. If I'm going to imitate God, the best place to look to see how God would behave would be in Jesus, because he's God in the flesh. And so what did he do that is worth imitating? And one of the things that I see Jesus was good at was showing mercy. I mean, he showed mercy to those who needed it most. Just throw your mind back and remember a situation in John chapter 8 where a woman is brought before him who's been caught in adultery. This woman is standing there and she is encircled by a group of men who are ready to stone her because the punishment for adultery is death. Jesus does something peculiar. We don't even know why he did it. He kind of gets down on his hunkers and he starts writing in the dirt. A lot of people have tried to guess, what is he writing? Maybe he's writing the Ten Commandments. Maybe Jesus is writing, he who is without sin, throw the first stone, you know. Maybe he's listing the name of her lovers and some of them are present holding stones. We have no idea what he's writing in the dirt. But what we do know is what he says when he stands back up. The scripture says that Jesus straightened up, and he asked her, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? Because all of those men that were so vicious had already gone. And when she says no, Jesus says these beautiful words of mercy. Neither do I condemn you. Go and leave your life of sin. You see Jesus showing that kind of mercy again and again, not just to a woman caught in adultery. He showed it to tax collectors. And you and I really can't get our brains around what it meant to be a tax collector in first century Israel. It was terrible. Because basically what you did was what Esau did when he wanted the red stew and he gave his birthright to his brother Jacob. As a tax collector, you had traded your national allegiance and your spiritual inheritance for cash. And that was awful. And yet Jesus, he's accused of hanging out with them because he's showing them mercy. He shows mercy to foreigners, to the woman who came to him and said, but even the dogs get the scraps. And Jesus showed his mercy to her. To the centurion who came to him, Jesus showed mercy to aliens. And Jesus shows mercy even to his followers, even to Simon Peter, even to someone that should have known better. It's like a lot of times in Christianity, we're all about, well, yeah, the lost people, we've got to show them mercy so they can come into the kingdom. But buddy, once you're in here, you better. Jesus isn't like that. There Simon Peter is, you know, and Jesus knows everything. And he knows that in just a few hours, Peter is going to say, I would rather be cursed than to be called one of his. I would rather be cursed than to be called a follower of Jesus. Jesus knows he's going to say that, but Peter is all full of bravado. And Peter says, you know, even if everybody else forsakes you, Jesus, you can count on me. I'll be there because I'm better. I'm better. Listen to the mercy dripping from the words of Jesus as he addresses that. Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift you as wheat, but I've prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned back, strengthen your brothers. In other words, Simon, you are such a braggart. You're such a braggart. And because of that, you've kind of given the enemy a foothold that he is gonna put you to the test, buddy. But I'm in your corner, Simon. I love you. And even though you're a braggart, I have such mercy on you. I am praying for you that you will make it through this. And in the end, you'll be a better man than you were when you made that boast. See, Jesus specializes in showing mercy to those who need it. So if I want to imitate God, I need to be a person who doesn't demand retribution. I need to be a person who offers mercy. But don't get the idea that Jesus is some kind of a softy. He's a merciful God. But another way we imitate him, apart from showing this kind of mercy, another way we imitate him is by being a straight shooter, being willing to tell it like it is. Straight shooters are hard to come by, except on cable news networks. And even then, I'm not really sure anybody's shooting straight there, you know? But at least they're saying their opinions. Jesus was a straight shooter. He was never soft on sin. Even in John 8, when he says, "Neither do I condemn you," he deals with the woman caught in adultery very clearly by saying, "Go, leave your life of sin." Jesus was such a straight shooter that he would confront those who would not repent. And he would just nail them and say, "You must repent." Imagine the rich young man, we used to call him the rich young ruler, who came to Jesus and says, "I want to be your follower." And Jesus looks at him and loves him, but he talks straight to him. What he's saying is, your money's way too important to you. If you want to be my follower, you're going to have to deal with a money issue in your life, because you can't love me and love money at the same time. He dealt with him very straight, very clearly. Jesus was such a straight shooter that you know, you can think about what led them to put him on the cross. And we talked a little earlier about part of it was because they called him a blasphemer. But you have to know, in a group of people that large, there's probably a lot of blasphemers that never went to the cross. One of the reasons Jesus went to the cross, from a human perspective, was because he was such a straight shooter. And he would sit down and he would say, "I'm going to tell you seven things that are wrong with you guys. Woe to you, Pharisees." And he laid it on the line with brutal honesty when a situation called for it. If you and I are going to imitate him, there are going to have to be times that we can talk straight, that we say what needs to be said. I'm thinking about how to imitate Jesus. I'm thinking, I do it if I show mercy. I do it if I'm a straight shooter. You do it as well when you teach right from wrong. I love to look at Jesus' teaching style. There have been times that people have said this to me for all my years of ministry, even when I first started out. "You know, Pastor Steve, you're a little more of a teacher than you are a preacher." And I always regard that as a compliment, you know? And the reason I do is because I want to imitate the greatest teacher there ever was, Jesus. How many times in the gospel do you read, "And he sat down and he taught them, saying, blessed are the..." He's teaching. All the time, Jesus is teaching right from wrong. In a Sermon on the Mount, he uses this technique where he says, "You have heard it said, but I say to you. You have heard it said, but I say to you." What an amazing way to communicate truth. Now, you don't have to be Pastor Steve to do that. You were put in situations at work and in your family and in your community and your neighborhood where when somebody's talking, you can say, "You know, I had heard it said this, but I have learned that the Bible says this." And when you do that, you're imitating Jesus. You're imitating God. If you want to be like God, teach people right from wrong. Now, what does it look like when we imitate God? And let me just, first of all, say, it looks peculiar to those whose hearts are sleeping. If you decide you're going to imitate Jesus, people are going to think, there's a certain group of people who are just going to think, well, that's weird. Wow, that's weird. Huh. Never saw that. In fact, you can represent God perfectly because Jesus did. And some people will remain clueless. I say that because of things like the incident that happened in John 12. In John 12, Jesus is speaking to a crowd. He's teaching, and he says these words, "Father, glorify your name." And a voice comes from heaven that says, "I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again." Okay, it's the voice of God. It's coming out of heaven. It's loud enough that Jesus and everyone else can hear it, but listen to the very next verse. John 12, 29 says, "The crowd that was there heard it and said it had thundered. Others said that an angel had spoken to him." It thundered? It thundered? God speaks from heaven and they think it's thunder? Here's what that tells me. That if I'm going to imitate God, there will be people that no matter how well I do it, if they are spiritually sleeping, they just won't get it. And I could be Billy Graham or Mother Teresa, and they say, "Did it thunder? Did you hear something?" I don't know what that was. And I want to say to you, don't beat yourself up on that. Just because people think, well, that's weird. Just because people don't get it. Continue to fulfill the command in Ephesians 5:1, be imitators of God. Some of them won't see it when you imitate God. You know, to the godless, though, it doesn't look strange. It just looks downright annoying when you imitate God. When you decide you're going to be following God instead of following the world, there are people in the world that are going to be ticked off about that. I can tell you, when I was at the university, I used to drink. And when I stopped drinking, and my drinking was out of control at the university, when I stopped drinking, it really bugged a lot of people. And people that bugged most didn't bug the people that were asleep. You know, people whose hearts were asleep, spiritually speaking, are like, "Huh, Steve stopped drinking. How about that?" But there was a certain group of people that found it very annoying. And I can remember being held down by really big guys and having alcohol poured into my mouth because they were really troubled that I had stopped drinking. You understand? It is annoying to some people when you follow God. And, you know, it took me a long time as a pastor to realize that when people don't like my sermons, it's probably not because they're not good sermons. I'm not saying I'm a good preacher. I think I'm a decent preacher. But I know it's not because of my sermon that they're unhappy. It's not because of the skill that's involved in that. It's not because of my technique. It's because of what's being said. And their objection is really an objection that comes from them being under conviction and feeling like, "Well, I don't know if I want to do that. That really annoys me that he would say that." You see, sometimes when you imitate God, you're speaking for him, you're portraying him, and there are people who find that annoying. But the beauty of imitating Jesus is that to the hungry people, it's magnetic. It's attractive. Yeah, Jesus was popular for a lot of reasons. He was popular because he did miracles, and that's bound to draw a crowd. He turned water into wine. Really? Where is he? That sounds pretty cool. He healed my sick child. Really? Well, I need to find him. Where is he? I'll follow that one. Yeah. He fed people's stomachs from just a few fish and a little bit of bread. Hey, that's not a bad thing. The economy's not so hot since these tax collectors are here. I think, yeah, who's that? Jesus did that? I'll go ahead and follow him. He rebuked oppressive leadership. That is always popular among the masses. But the real reason that Jesus' genuine followers committed their hearts to him is because he fed their hearts. Do you understand that? And they saw something inside of him because they were so hungry, spiritually speaking. They resonated with his message. His presence would fill their lives. When he spoke, it clicked with them and enlivened them. And how he lived connected with their hearts and caused their hearts to beat. Now hear this. When you imitate Jesus, some of the very same things can happen in your life. Because people will see a change in you, and they will want that same kind of thing. I have a friend who had a job for a number of years, maybe a dozen years. He worked in his factory, sort of in a laboratory environment. And he got serious about Jesus. He was a Christian when he started there, but he hadn't lived well. And he really entered into a deeper life with Jesus where he fully surrendered to Christ, and the fullness of God's Spirit was much more evident in him than it had been before. And he said to me, he said, "Pastor Steve, I've applied for a new job and I got it in another location." And I said, "Why did you do that?" He said, "Because I'd been in that first place for so long and I'd done so many wrong things. I just wanted to go somewhere I could shine my light brightly." And I said, "I'm so sorry he did that." I never told him this. But I thought, what an effect he could have had if he had gone to work Monday morning and said, "You know, I haven't been living like a Christian, and Jesus has made a huge change in my life just in the past couple of weeks. And I'm a different person." You know, there would have been guys that go, "Yeah, let's see how long this lasted." But in his life, it has lasted for 20 years. And had he lived that out in front of the people he messed up in, it would have been even a more powerful testimony than the one he has in his new location. Because when people see what Jesus is doing in your life and you begin to imitate him, hungry people take note and are like, "Yeah, I want what he has." A lot of you don't know Bill Bloom. Bill passed away several years ago. I did his funeral. When a church was being built here on Susquehanna Avenue, this part of the building, of course there were three houses next door to us here, but this part of the building was being built, Bill Bloom was the electrician who did the electrical work here. He was probably in his 50s at the time. Would that be a good guess, Jim? I would guess in his 50s at the time. And he did a great job doing the wiring here, dedicated, donated his time in doing that. Bill had just come to Christ a few years before that, and people have told me the change in his life was dramatic. One day, I was visiting someone in the intensive care unit at the local hospital here. And as I was in there visiting this person, it was one of those situations where, "Pastor, my aunt's neighbor's in the intensive care unit. Can you go visit him?" And yeah, I'll do that cold visit. So I went in and went in to talk to him. He saw me walk in with a Bible in hand, and he saw me. I was a pastor. I think I probably had a tie on at that time in my ministry. And he was just, "Oh boy, I don't need this guy." The guy laying in the intensive care unit said, "Ah." Oh. And I'll never understand that. I'll never understand how you can be in an intensive care unit and have no interest in hearing from God. I just don't get that. But that's how people are. So I'm trying desperately to connect with this person because I believe that if you can't connect with someone on some personal level, you really have very little ability to talk to them about a deeply personal thing like their walk with God or lack thereof. And so finally, I said to him, "I pastor at Kerwinsville Alliance. Do you know anyone from that church?" That can be a dangerous question, but not in this church. I've never had anyone when I say that, "Yeah, I know some of your people. They're awful." I've never had that happen. But I can imagine that happening in some situations in other locations, perhaps. But I said, "Do you know anyone from Kerwinsville Alliance?" And that guy, he turned and he looked at me. He said, "Yeah, I know Bill Bloom." We talked a little bit about Bill Bloom. And then that man said words like this: "You know, I knew Bill before he started going to church. And he was awful. And church turned his life around completely. He is so much better and such a better man now." And I had the privilege of saying to that man, "That wasn't church that did that. That was Jesus that did that." And because of Bill Bloom's choice to imitate Jesus, that man was open to hearing from me very specifically about Jesus. Do you see that? How when you imitate God, it's a magnetic kind of thing. I like to think I'm pretty good at connecting with people, but nothing connects with people as much as when they see genuine change in an individual. And when you live a life that imitates Jesus, hungry hearts are drawn to you better hungry hearts are drawn to Jesus. So let's talk for a moment about what's required in imitating God. And the text tells us, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Pastor Steve, you started this in Ephesians. You haven't been back there the whole time. Well, I'd like you to think of that as being an introduction to the sermon, but it's not. Don't worry. I want you to look at the text, though. Ephesians chapter 5, we're going to see that the first thing that is mentioned here in imitating God is a profound awareness of God's great love. Look at verse 1 again. It says, be imitators of God, therefore, as dearly loved children. And I believe that Paul uses that phrasing very intentionally because dearly loved children automatically imitate their parents. When my son Tim was a baby, I had a Yamaha XJ750. That was one rockin' motorcycle. It was just a fantastic machine. It was bright red. I had a red helmet that I wore. And I could just go down the road like fire. In fact, people in my church would see me driving that motorcycle and they'd say, Pastor, isn't there a verse in the Bible that says you need to obey the laws of the land? And I would say, I obey those laws. I pay every fine I get. It was a magical machine. I would take my little boy, Timmy, on that motorcycle. I'd sit him on the gas tank, and he'd have his hands on the gas tank, and he'd ride around the yard. You know, poor Laurel. I know she had to be dying, you know. But I loved my boy, and I loved that motorcycle. And he loved it, too. And he loved his dad. And one time, he's riding his tricycle, and he stopped, and he crawled off of it there in the kitchen, and he got into the cabinet, and he pulled out the lettuce crisper. And he put that thing on his head, and he logged about 100,000 miles with that lettuce crisper riding around that parsonage that day. Why did he do that? Why would he do that? It's because his father was so central in his life, because his dad was so consistently on his mind that he simply and automatically imitated his dad. That's what it is. And our imitation of God should be that way, where without thinking of it, because God is so consistently on my mind, because I'm always thinking of Him, and He is so central in my life, that I automatically imitate my Father in heaven. He's on my mind, and He's central in my life because of His great, great love for me. So imitating God requires an awareness of His great love, and it requires a sacrificial heart as well. Again, let's go right back to the text, okay? Look at verse 2. And live a life of love, just as Christ loved us and gave Himself for us as a fragrant offering and a sacrifice to God. In a few moments, you're going to be holding the bread and drinking the cup. And that should remind you that in showing mercy, Jesus made a huge sacrifice. No greater sacrifice could have been made. And as we imitate Him, we're called to do the same kind of thing. I believe that there's something hardwired into humanity that admires sacrifice. I mean, whether it's Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett at the Alamo making a sacrifice there, or whether it's Commander Spock and he's saying the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, or if it's the many Bothans who died bringing the necessary information right before the Battle of Endor. The importance of sacrifice is written into our history, into our movies, into our literature. It's written into our DNA. And I believe that God put that admiration of sacrifice inside of us so that we would recognize, appreciate, and even imitate Jesus' sacrifice for our sins. If you want to imitate God, you're going to have to be a man, be a woman of sacrifice. And as you take the Lord's Supper in a few moments, ask yourself, God, how can I be a person of sacrifice? What does it look like? I think that imitating God requires moral uprightness. Strike the words, I think. Imitating God requires moral uprightness. I say that because of verses 5 through 7. For of this you can be sure, no immoral, impure, or greedy person, such a man's an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Let no one deceive you with empty words. Because of such things, God's wrath comes on those who are disobedient. So in order to imitate God, you have to separate yourself from evil things in the world. You have to separate yourself from immorality, impurity, greed. You even have to be cautious about your interaction with people who behave in those ways. Not that you separate yourself and fail to act as salt and light to them, but look at what verse 7 says. It says, therefore, don't even be partners with them. Don't even be partners with them. What that means is if we want to imitate God, we've got to keep ourselves pure. You know, there's a thinking that kind of supposes that if we want people to come to God, which we do because we've discovered forgiveness of sin in Him and we want to share that with others, if we want to be effective witnesses for Christ, then we need to do everything we can to appear normal, you know? And I think part of that is because maybe my generation and the one that follows it looks at previous generations and says, wow, those Christians were anything but normal. They were just weird. And sometimes that's true. Sometimes my generation's a little bit weird. And unnecessarily so. But that has caused some Christians to think, and a lot of Christians has kind of plugged into the thinking, that wants to say to people, hey, I'm a Christian, and I'm no different than you, so you can be a Christian as well. And you might call that the normalcy technique of evangelism. It's where you make Christianity appear to agree with societal norms. But that's meaningless. It is absolutely meaningless. It is clearly unbiblical. And it is non-functional. It doesn't work. It doesn't work because our society is all those things we just read about in verses 5 through 7. Hop on the internet, ride uptown, turn on your HDTV, and you will see immorality, impurity, greed. You will see idolatry, deception, emptiness. You will see disobedience to God everywhere. And so being a Christian doesn't mean imitating the world. It means imitating God. It means being different. Some people will find that odd. Some people will find that annoying. But some people, there are people who, when they see you imitating Jesus, their hungry hearts will find it intriguing. And then you will have opportunity to say, you know, it wasn't church that did this to me. It was Jesus who did this to me. And in imitating God, you'll lead them to discover God. You see, when you live a life that imitates Jesus, hungry hearts are drawn to you. Better, they're drawn to Jesus. So as we take the Lord's Supper, ask yourself a couple different questions. Number one, am I imitating God? And if I'm not, why? What am I afraid of? What am I missing? And then ask yourself this, how can I better imitate God? And He'll tell you. If you ask Jesus those questions, He will tell you. I want to ask the communion stewards to come at this time. Not sure that I have enough this morning. I have Perry, and I have Josh, and I have Jim, and I'm going to grab one more. I'm going to grab Ray. That'll teach you to sit right up toward the front, Ray. Okay. Ray's thinking to himself, I don't know if I ever paid attention during communion. Don't worry, the table's moved. That's what I would be thinking, Ray. I didn't mean to talk about you. Everything's different this morning, so you'll be fine, okay? Here's what we're going to do. We're going to distribute the bread. I'm going to ask you to hold your portion until all have been served, and then we'll take it together. Here's what I'd like you to just be thinking during this time. I'd like you just to be thinking about how you're imitating God And I'd like you to be asking him to make you a better impersonator, imitation of him.